Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, Hannah Storm.
And me, John Crowley.
In our podcast, we speak with colleagues from across our journalism industry about the stories they've covered and their own stories as well. We hear from them about how our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take discussions around mental health more seriously and how journalism can shape and normalise conversations around well-being.
Hannah and I are both directors of Headlines Network and have been involved in journalism for decades. We know that journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in, wherever they work.
Stuart Ramsey is Sky News' longest-serving foreign correspondent. Across a storied 30-year career, he's covered 18 separate conflicts, covering the world's biggest news stories. He spent significant time in Iraq and Syria and has reported extensively on the migrant crisis in Central America. In March 2020, he was the first TV journalist to go inside hospitals hard hit by Italy's coronavirus epidemic. Last year, he reported on the fall of Kabul in Afghanistan, and more recently, he spent significant time in Ukraine. Hi Stuart, thank you for joining us. You've been in the news yourself recently and we'd like to talk about that shortly, but what was it that made you really want to be a journalist?
It's quite a long story actually, but I was actually a drummer in a band, would you believe, and got kicked out. I actually wanted to be a rock star. And a friend said, why don't you come to back to Wales, which is where I'm from, and I applied as an intern at a local newspaper. And I suppose I was 21 and I've never left, basically. I trained there, eventually ended up working as a freelancer in London on the Nationals. I worked for a national news agency, went to the old TVAM, worked there as a producer, and then eventually as a reporter, and then I was sort of given to Sky on a free transfer. And when TVAM lost its franchise, and I have literally been there ever since. Although I would just quickly say I've worked in lots of bureaus, I've run bureaus all over the world, so I haven't just done one job. I think you'd have gone mad in 30 years at Sky if you only did one job.
Quite a jump from rock star to reporter, eh?
Yeah, though I've, you know, there's some similarities, I think, but let's not go into that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've made your name in some ways. I suspect that probably being a reporter may be somewhat more interesting in terms of the places you see and the people you meet. Maybe a bit more arduous on your health and well-being, but as you say, maybe let's not go into that. As we mentioned before, after years of telling the story of other people, of amplifying their stories, you became the story a little earlier on this year, didn't you? After you and your colleagues were ambushed by Russian soldiers during the invasion of Ukraine, particularly in Bucha, where you were. Tell us a little bit more about what happened that day.
Yeah, it was the fifth day of the war. We'd actually been in country for nearly 2 months prior to that, mainly working in the east, but we had come back to Kyiv. We were, I think, like a few other journalists I was talking to, other colleagues, were hoping to lay low, that we assumed the Russians would just come in very quickly and that would behave like you would expect a conquering but professional army to behave. And our idea was to actually sort of come out and when the Russians were on the streets of Kyiv. That clearly wasn't happening. And even by day five, after we'd spent at least 3 days, I think, under curfew, we were able to go out and we were trying to go to this unknown town at that place that we knew Russians had been attacking. And that was Bucha. And of course, we've come to know the atrocities that were committed in Bucha. It took hours, but we couldn't actually get there. The battle space was changing all the time. There were helicopter gunships in the air. And it was getting late. We'd left early, but by now it was probably about 4 in the afternoon. And remember, it was winter as well then. So it was getting quite dark and we called it a day because the checkpoints were getting jumpier and jumpier and it was much more difficult. And the battle was getting nearer and nearer to the positions we were. All the roads that we had taken to get to where we were now part of the battlefield. We stopped at a checkpoint heading back towards Kyiv and asked the police the best direction. And they pointed us to the road, which is their checkpoint was on, which is the M06 and the E40. And we drove down the M06 towards Kyiv, which is just outside of town. You could see Kyiv in the distance, if you like. It was eerie because there weren't any cars on the road. We realised pretty much at the same time that the bridge had been blown in front of us when the first round struck the car. I saw it on the front left-hand side, or at least something hit the car. There was some discussion between the group in the vehicle. You know, what did we drive over something or have we been shot? I was pretty convinced we were shot. We pulled over, the car had a flat, and the next minute we were under fire, and it was very, very sustained. two of my colleagues were able to get out really fast. The three of us, that's Dominique Van Heerden, my producer, and Richie Mockler, my cameraman, weren't out as quickly as that. But we, at this stage, just to give you some perspective, we actually knew we had to debus, as it's called. We just assumed that it was actually a mistake, that we'd driven into a Ukrainian checkpoint and that they had just opened up and that they would stop. So we started shouting that we're journalists. And if anything, that intensified the fire, and it became absolutely clear then that it wasn't going to stop and the car was being slowly but surely destroyed. Dominique told me later, basically, I'm going to die if I stay in this car. I might die if I get out, but I'm definitely getting out. And so she got out and crawled along the floor to a motorway embankment and dived down where our other two colleagues were. Richie and I were still in the car, both, I suppose, waiting for a moment to get out. But I was thinking, right, this level of fire can't continue. I'm going to die. And I remember thinking, I wonder if it's going to hurt. And then I got hit by a bullet into my lower back. And I didn't know at the time, but it went straight through me. And I actually fairly calmly in my mind put my helmet on, was about to get out of the car, leant back and picked up my phones, which I still can't believe I did. And then got out of the car. And at that point on the video that you hear is Richie saying, "Where are you going?" Because he can't really believe that I'm standing up and sort of slightly jog towards the end of the embankment. But I looked down and it was very steep actually. I could see the others down there. I started running and I effectively dived down. We've been back since and it was a pretty long way down, very steep. And I pretty much landed on my head, probably knocked myself out, though I don't recall. Richie was still in the car, went very quiet, and then he, a few seconds later, I'm told by the others, because I can't remember him, he came over the side and ran down the hill. That was just the start of what was going to become a really long extraction process. We ran along the motorway, made our way inside a factory unit, the gates were open, and some three caretakers came out of a warehouse and beckoned us inside, and basically we had to stay there. Now, a huge amount of fighting started outside. We don't know who was fighting whom, but eventually, and Dominique made all the calls and our producers elsewhere, and eventually the police were told by, we believe, the Secret Service to come and get us. Interesting, again, later, the police who rescued us told us that the buildings we had been in were destroyed shortly after we left. I've been back. I mean, they were absolutely levelled. Our one, funnily enough, was on the edge of this huge industrial park that was completely destroyed. It was hit, but the guys inside survived. So we don't know, but there is some discussion. Did the Secret Service, had they an intercept? Did they know that these buildings were going to get targeted? We don't know, but suddenly we went from being told you have to stay there tonight and we'll come for you in the morning to bang, 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 come with us quickly, where the Ukrainian police get in the car and we sped away. And that took quite a long time to get out. But yeah, it was interesting being part of the news, but we wanted to report on it because we knew what was happening to lots of Ukrainians, and we've seen that very much since. And I think a point to remember is, like, what was happening and what happened to us in the car. We've investigated this, but later on you've seen so many people died on that motorway that were targeted by Russian soldiers over the coming, I think, 3 weeks or so. But there have been incidents in other parts of the country as well. And the point I want to make is, what happened to us was not exceptional. What was exceptional was that Richie filmed it all. And that was what was so shocking, because it's very rare to be on the inside of a vehicle being attacked. I've seen lots of vehicles being attacked. I'm usually on the outside looking in. But that was what was exceptional about this.
Stuart, you've been in other tight spots around the world, but how do you cope with the knowledge that this was such a close shave? I watched the special piece that you did with Kay Burley on Sky News when you were looking at the footage and talking about it. What is it like looking back at the footage now, and how do you cope with the knowledge kind of with what happened?
Interestingly, we did a first podcast we did, where it's actually for Sky, where they played the audio to us rather than the pictures. And I broke down in tears immediately. And I think all of us found it quite hard. more so than looking at the pictures, which is the sort of reference points that we know and understand. And and that's our business. You know, we work with pictures and sound, but having it stripped out and hearing all of us screaming, and Richie particularly. By the way, he was not shouting or screaming any more than the rest of us. It was just that his microphone was nearest to him. Obviously, it was the camera mic. It is interesting looking back at it. I don't have... I actually looked at it yesterday, actually. More journalistically, I was actually wanting to see the specific things that Dominique and I were talking about. But it was fine. I mean, it wasn't like it's brought back terrible memories. I mean, at the beginning, it was obviously harder. In the first day, after we finally got actually back out of Kyiv, got to the west, into Lviv, and the three of us gathered in Richie's room to look at the rushes. I mean, everyone was in silence and absolutely gobsmacked. It's like, how on earth did we get out of that? Bear in mind, all five of us got out. And just to tell you, actually, we went back to do this, and Dominique rang me and said, have you looked at your gear since we've got back? I said, you know what, I haven't even seen my boots since we got back. This is after a couple of months being here. And so I got out my bag and I looked at my armour and I saw a nick on it. And another, and I was hit six more times, which none of us knew anything about. That was the first time. So I thought I was hit by one magic bullet that passed straight through me. Actually, I'd been pretty much smashed up. That was fairly intense, I can tell you. It was actually on my birthday. My wife came into the bedroom and I was sort of in tears going, oh my God, look at that. But it was more about, this is happening to all sorts of people. But it really came back to me. It's like, our gear and our training saved me 100%. And yet civilian families have no chance. They're definitely going to die. That's what was upsetting me, and that was something that has been a recurring theme for all of us, that not only were we lucky, but we actually had the gear to protect ourselves, and that's the only difference between our attack and many other attacks that we've documented. But since, so yes, you get over those. You know, I got blown up in Mosul. I don't particularly like seeing that picture very much. That was unpleasant. And I've been kidnapped at least twice. Those are pretty bad incidents as well, particularly in Ukraine. That was horrendous. And that was the full bag over the head job and all the rest of it. And that didn't actually last that long, but it was terrifying. So those incidents, this one by far the worst in terms of, I actually got shot. But actually, those incidents all rate up there as well. It's just this one looks so dramatic, again, because it was filmed.
You talk a little bit there about, well, a lot of things, you know, this fact that you were shot, but you received the training, and then you were shot once, but you had these kind of six extra bullets kind of directed at your equipment as well. And I mean, that's just hearing you talk about that it's incredibly humbling hearing you talk about that, but also in the way that you're talking about the fact that actually your comparison is nothing compared with the trauma that the Ukrainian civilians have gone through. So it's really interesting to hear you say that. I'm very struck by how you refer to your team. And when we've had previous podcasts with people like Lise Doucette and Lindsay Hilsum and Clive Myrie, they've often talked about quite how important the team is in journalism and quite how you survive together, you get through things together. Tell me a little bit more about the relationship that you've obviously had, a very strong relationship with Dominique, who you've talked about, your producer, who you've been working with for many years now. How important is that team to you?
Oh, it's absolutely vital. It is very much a television thing, of course, because there's pretty almost always going to be three of you, maybe down to two. I spend a lot of time and many years with Richie. We're just us without producer, but then Dominique has been with us for a few years now, and I always work with her. It is absolutely vital. I think newspapers are often alone, but they often team up, if you know what I mean. They will often team up with television crews and stuff, not least because they get a free ride most of the time. But they like to work together. We, you know, without that team spirit, if you like. And you can see it in the footage. You know, as soon as we get down the bank, everyone's together. We go off in a line together. We're talking constantly about where we go, and we talk a lot when working on the risk for reward of what we do, and we have very strict rules within our risk for reward thing. It's basically, who do we think this is a good story to go and do? Or actually, do we think we want to stop to get to go to the loo. Is this road safe enough to stop on, or should we move? It's as simple as this. So it actually goes from very big things like, do we leave Kyiv today and go to Butcher? Massive decision to make. Do we take this road? Do we go down this road? Now, if the team disagrees, if one person's saying, I can't go any further, we have a rule that you just don't go any further. It doesn't usually happen, but it has happened. But because of that whole, if you take the rule being the risk for reward, getting out of the car, getting to where we wanted to get safe, was a group decision based as each one went along saying, I think we should go this way, the other saying, no, let's try that, and eventually you reach consensus. But it has to be done really quickly. But you cannot do our job without that team dynamic, because you wouldn't survive just on your own at all. But it's interesting though, and we know from talking to psychologists, is that, you know, in a major traumatic incident like that, it's quite possible for people who don't have that team spirit to literally run off in different directions. One straight up the motorway, one going towards where the firing came from, that type of thing. Because I think that we work so often together, we know that the best place to be is together, and then make a decision as a group as to which way we should go.
It's something Lise was talking about quite a lot, about kind of how when you have the really strong dynamics there as the team, you know, you can make those decisions more effectively together, and those decisions about how do you support each other as well. And I was also just thinking then specifically, you know, slightly away from the team and back to you as kind of the physical experience and the psychological toll of the kind of recent shooting. You were shot is the kind of honest thing here, right? You were shot. How are you now? I mean, you received a bullet right way through your lower back, and it came out the other side, you say. So how are you physically doing now?
No, I'm fine. It's healed. I've just come back from another tour of Ukraine. So, you know, we've been back, and we were in the east. It was a bit of a wobble from all of us at the beginning. Not all of us went together, by the way. It was just me and Dominic as the original team. I'm really glad we didn't all go together. First, we'd have done nothing but talk about it. And secondly, I think the team dynamic would have been a little bit strained, because everyone's dealt with it in different ways. So yeah, no, physically, I'm absolutely fine. I'm amazed at how well you can heal and really how quickly. I was very lucky. I had the surgeon who was on duty at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford. It was a former military surgeon in Afghanistan. So, I mean, I was in very, very good hands. He's taken a lot more bullets out of people than just one. I was talking to the psychologist about this, and I asked her, is there a big difference between actually being shot and almost being shot? And she said there was much discussion about this, but in her view, she didn't think there was an awful lot of difference at all. And so what happened to me, yeah, I got a bullet through me, but I don't think that what happened to me was any more troublesome mentally to me than Dominique or to Richie or to the others in the car. Martin and Andre. I'm of that view. I think that is correct. I'm not sure there's a huge difference. We've got many of our friends out there now in the East are being regularly surviving multiple missile attacks. I mean, the effects on them is not much difference. I mean, a missile hit in building 1 mile away or 1 meter away, I don't think there's much difference between the two. You know, so I think that the traumatic event isn't made worse by actually being injured. I think the effect on you mentally and actually physically is identical.
You've previously said that the video, which shows the moment of the ambush, that it almost wasn't broadcast. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it was a very interesting one. It took a few days to get it together. We fed it in, and I think, I'll be honest with you, I think our bosses were actually traumatised. We know that, I think the head of Foreign News had actually opened the file to look at, but it was then called to a meeting. When they came back, two of the team were sort of looking at the video completely open mouth, and I think everyone was traumatized. Not least, there's a couple of reasons. One, it is particularly traumatic because you can hear your own friends and colleagues shouting and etc. The bullets, of course, are flying in. And their view that they wanted to have a little think about it went down very badly with me, to be absolutely honest. So there was much discussion about it, and eventually they decided to run it. There was a variety of reasons that did come up. One was concern for colleagues because we had been hit. One was concern, was it possibly too much navel gazing, which was a big issue that we all acknowledged straight away, which is why I mean, if you actually look in the piece, I barely mention that I've been shot. I mean, this is just and the piece talks about the attacks before on people, and it ends with that. So I think they realised eventually that holding on to it or not running it would be crazy, and eventually they relented. I don't think they were really against running it. I think what they were concerned about was just the effect it would have on us, our families, the staff. Genuinely, I think they were completely wrong, but I think that their feelings were absolutely genuine, however incorrect in my opinion.
Those worries about the effect it has on people, on colleagues, on you, your families, I mean, what was the response amongst people who you know in terms of kind of seeing the video? What was the response?
No, I mean, shock. And horror. My kids are very used to me being in dangerous places, so I talked to them about it. In fact, my daughter wrote, because she was really worried about it. She's 21, she wrote, I thought it was going to be worse than this, Dad, because I've seen so many bad things. So I thought, because you'd said, how bad? I said, yeah, well, it's been slightly cut down. It was a bit longer, but actually, we haven't dwelt on the fact that I've been shot. Yeah, I mean, colleagues were absolutely shocked, and close friends. Absolute disbelief and horror. I think in the business, I think I'm quite well known for being quite safe. I mean, some could be said being a dreadful scaredy cat, which I think is actually fair to say. But I think that what has shocked quite a few friends in the business, and not particularly friends, is that they didn't expect someone like me to get shot. There are others who have reputations for being sort of gung-ho, but I have a reputation for being very, very careful about what we're doing and planning quite a lot. And I think for colleagues as well, it's almost like, shit, if Stuart gets shot, then this place has got to be really bad after all the things he's done. And I think that affected... I mean, I directly know for a fact that a number of camera crews and reporters immediately said they wouldn't go. As a direct result, and I think they've calmed down now, and they see that you can recover and all the rest of it. But I think that effect was pretty big, and just the number of people who wrote from all over the world made us realise just how much this had been seen. And Ukraine was obviously, and still is, a huge story, but it was even more so then. And I think what happened to all of us, and I suppose the fact that we survived it made it even more remarkable, I suppose. Because, I mean, I talked to the military friends about this, and Richie, for example, was a soldier. He's happy for me to say that. They train to carry out ambushes. Nobody is meant to get out of the car. Not five. It's one... Okay, but you do a follow-up and kill them. And by the way, that's what we were really scared about. We expected a follow-up because, that had gone wrong for the shooters. By the way, just to say, we've done a lot of work on this, and we've spoken a lot to the police, and we've interviewed them, and there was no doubt that this was a Russian team. I mean, and there was doubt at the beginning, and some people cast doubt on our reporting, but actually there is now no doubt now that there was a Russian advance team. So anyway, yes, no. Just to say, the effect on a lot of people was trauma, concern, and an awful lot of people asking me to stop and retire. Interestingly, not my family. He's just said, there's no point. There's no good point asking him. He's not going to do it.
Just picking up on that, I mean, it's so interesting to hear you talk about the risk of the reward, and then the kind of, reputationally, how you're regarded as one of these guys who just, you don't take ridiculous risks. And actually our last podcast guest Mark Little was talking about how some people are schooled in the kind of gung-ho school of journalism, and others are kind of just a bit more risk averse. So it was a real reality check, I guess, for a lot of people, kind of seeing this happen to you and suddenly going, oh my god, actually, if it can happen to Stuart, it can happen to us too. Kind of moving on from that, talking a little bit about when you said that only two of you of the original team went back to Ukraine because you all coped with it and you all dealt with it in different ways. How did you kind of deal with that after so many years working in difficult situations? How do you deal with coming home from a really difficult job to being back in the real world with your family, as it were?
I suppose what's slightly different about this one is that coming back for me involved actually going to hospital, and it wasn't, I had to get better, and therefore it's a slightly different experience to normal, which is what all the others had, which is, one day you're in a war zone, and the next day you're home. And that is difficult. It's difficult for everyone. Firstly, you always come back exhausted. I find that you're often quite irritable, but that's probably because you're tired. In the days gone by, when my kids were much younger, they're not now, they're adults now, but when they were much younger, it was much more mum saying to them, let's greet dad and everything, but you know, over the next day or so, just give him a bit of space so he calms down a bit. You know, teams miss each other when they come back. And so, you know, you've suddenly gone from being in one group where you're all focused on one thing. It's often fun. You know, it's not like it isn't. It is fun, and dinners are nice, and then suddenly you're back and you've got responsibilities and bills to pay, and, you know, something's gone wrong with the washing machine, you've got to sort it out. And it's those sort of type of things can actually, you know, really play on you a bit, and you can become, as I say, quite irritable. Now, I'd say that was much worse when I was younger. As I've got older, I know what it's going to be like. But, you know, we do worry. Richie's, for example, his kids are much younger. He knew he had to go back and see them, and he had to sort of show that he was well, which means, you know, he can't be perhaps exhausted and not really wanting to talk because the kids need that. Dominique had to come home. Now, she has a family she's very close to, but in this instance chose to come back to her house where she lives alone. And I was very worried that she was going to be, but she wanted to just sleep and have peace and not have two nieces come and wake her up at 5 a.m, who are only very little. So everyone deals with things very differently. But essentially, you all have that sense of loss of camaraderie, I would say, but that you get over it quite quickly and then you're back onto your next job. It's not like it's just going to stop. You know, you have a little bit of time off and you're back. And I'm fortunate in as much as that. I work with a very small group of people. In fact, there's just another cameraman, me, Dominique and Richie, that work together all the time. So it's you know, that team never, you know, we can get on the phone to each other immediately. It's not like you've come back from a trip and you're hoping to get on another one. You know, that's what I do for a living. So it's you always know that you'll be going back. And sometimes you just want to rest more than anything, you know.
There is that sense of having to decompress, isn't it, as you said, from coming back from a conflict zone and then dealing with kind of, as you said, mundane things like fixing the washing machine. You said there that you've got better at demarking boundaries. Do you have any kind of process, or do you have any tips for people about how you do that? What do you do, or is it just a matter of time and spending maybe some time on your own to reflect?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is not to go on the lash as soon as you get back is a really good idea. And you won't believe how many people think it's a really bad idea, the amount of people who think it's a really good idea. And to actually realise that you have responsibility. Some of the things of actually coming back and having to fix the washing machine, etc., is actually quite therapeutic in itself. I think it's a good thing. And if people can, I would just advise them to just control the drinking and the partying and going out and actually sleep a lot and do mundane things like paying the bills and going to the bank, going shopping, doing the shopping. And then perhaps have a treat and treat yourself and, you know, whoever you're with, whoever's special with you, be it the kids or your wife or your husband or your partner or whatever, and try and give yourself a treat after a few days and then you'll get slowly back into it. That sudden coming back and euphoria of getting out of somewhere and it's been a great trip and it's got to stop, it's got to calm down. It's quite essential that you calm it down yourself and as controlled as way as possible.
I was just going to say, what was it like then going back to Ukraine? Because it feels like it's a bit of a jigsaw puzzle that you've been trying to sort out what happened to you emotionally. What was that like? Did you get a feeling of I had to go back there to kind of piece together what happened, but also just to go back to the space where you nearly lost your life?
I asked the shrink about this, and to my surprise, she said it was a really good idea to go back. All the bosses, but right up to the head of the whole of Sky Television, has been talking to me and our team on a regular basis. And most, I think, to a man and a woman, they were very concerned about us going back again, but sort of accepted that we were all determined to do so. It was an interesting experience because where we were shot is, as I say, basically the equivalent of the M4 into West London, right? So it's the motorway into West Kyiv. But the bridge had been blown by the Ukrainians to stop the Russian advance. I mean, that was probably one of the most significant developments of the war at that stage. But we drove right past where we'd been shot, but just and you had to wind around the embankment where I'd dived down. And, you know, our car had long since gone, which, by the way, is an interesting thing. We went and found our car and I retrieved my glasses out of it. But as we drove by, I didn't feel anything. I was interested. I was, like, really interested. It was like, wow, that's it. And Donnie, what do you think? She said, yeah, that's the thing. And it was just after that pylon, et cetera, et cetera. And drove into Kyiv. So really, it was just like, okay, well, we've done it now. And we went back and we spent a few days. And as I said, we filmed everything just for us or any documentaries we might do. And we went back to all the places and we met all the people we'd met and saved. And the police, you know, we gave a few presents to the police and to the caretakers. And then went and found our car. And that was a strange experience because obviously it was in this sort of car graveyard of cars that had all been shot up or blown up on the MO6 and the E40. And I got my glasses out of it, still on the back seat. Incredibly, you know, there's quite some really weird things, and that's what really struck me. So the headrests are just completely drilled with holes, and everywhere that we'd been sitting, there were things. We'd retrieved a bullet that's been hit. Ballistics guys tell us it looks like it's hit a hard object and stopped. Hard object being body armour plate, i.e. mine. So that was quite interesting to see. Other things that were odd, like the bottle of water that had been annoying me the whole time, which I'd put behind my headrest, was still there. You know, how is that? Dominique's coat was still there, again, which was pretty rank at this stage, because obviously it's been weeks and it had been in the snow. But, you know, all sorts of odd stuff like that. Again, much more interesting than emotional, though I have to say, looking at the car shot up like that was a real bit of a, God, how did we get out of that? But that's just the sheer number of rounds in it. And we had a security advisor with us, was explaining the grouping of the shots, which were very specific. Again, all of a professional hit. You know, it was first group on the driver, second group onto the front seat. It's stuff at the back sides. You know, they knew what they were doing.
You've talked there about kind of risk of one profound kind. I just want to move you away, if that's okay, from Ukraine a couple of years back to another huge story that's impacted the world recently, COVID. You were part of the Sky team, which really showed us the significance of COVID coming to Italy. And I want to kind of take you to that moment where you had to ask for clearance from Sky News bosses to enter hospitals in northern Italy as COVID began to take hold. What was that experience like? And given the complete and utter uncertainty of this story, how did you navigate those conversations with those near and dear to you about how you were going to kind of go into that situation?
I'll give you a bit of perspective on this. So it was announced that Lombardy was about to go into lockdown, yeah? And in a couple of days, and we'd never seen anything like this. It's hard to think now, but if you remember, nobody had seen a lockdown before apart from China, but we hadn't really seen it. And then it was announced that they were going to lock down the whole country. So I messaged and then spoke to he's the deputy, but effectively he's the head of the input, and said to him, we have to go to Italy. I have to go to Italy. We can't get locked outside. And there was a presentation team that were actually already there, but they were based in Rome. We'd just come back from El Salvador about 5 days earlier, and Dominique had actually gone to a wedding in South Africa. In the middle of the night, I rang her and said, pack your bags, we're going to Italy. She said, very nice, but why? Well, do you remember this virus that started spreading? Yeah, well, they're closing down Italy. So she made contacts there. She had friends who helped us. Yes, we'd been given permission to go to a country that was in lockdown. Then it was like, okay, we want to go to Milan and to Bergamo. Now, bear in mind that Sky News Italia, one of our companies, had just closed down its entire operation in Milan and moved it to Rome. So we had to then convince them, right, okay, now, okay, so the entire operation has moved to you're going forward. I said, yeah. So we drove up. And we had another hospital called Cremona near Bergamo who had agreed to see us on one day in that week. And we had a day to go to Bergamo. We already, therefore, had permission to go into the Cremona hospital. But somehow Bergamo would become more, it was more famous already that people were dying in large numbers. And we'd had ongoing discussions with our bosses about it. But I think they were putting off the final decision to when it was like, yes, you go or no, you don't. Thinking, right, they'll never get there. I suspect they just thought they'll not get to here or they'll not get permission. And we just kept getting nearer and more permissions. And eventually they had to make that decision. Dominique was reminding me that actually they did say no, and I'd forgotten they had. But we convened a meeting with them and all on the phone. That's me, Dominique, and Garwin McLuckie, who the cameraman who did that, who did that amazing job. And basically they spoke to us as a group and then individually about the expectation and risk. Now, we'd also, just before we'd arrived, really, really hurriedly had a training session with a specialist on Ebola. Garwin had covered Ebola outbreaks twice, really big outbreaks, and did some amazing award-winning work on that. So he'd been through, and as he said, and I think it became an important part of that discussion, if you get Ebola, there's a 90% chance you're going to die, minimum 90%. It's more like 97. But if you get this virus, as we understand it now, it's a sort of, at worst, 50-50 for being in intensive care. So the odds are quite good. We'd had this training. We had a lot of gear. We had all the gear. We'd been through the process of donning and doffing and all what it's called. And so we were fairly confident, taking that guidance, like, we know it's not as bad as Ebola and we know it's been covered, that that would be the best thing. And I think as we had that debate with them, eventually the head of news, John Riley, decided no, but took away, he wanted some time, and then spoke again, and then he said, listen, okay, if you're sure, you go in. But I mean, I would say, after we did the filming, and they couldn't get hold of us for a few hours, you know, they're genuinely thinking, you know, are they all dead in the Airbnb that we were in? And it was like, no, we were just editing. It was really busy. So it was an interesting thing because, and again, in hindsight, okay, it wasn't that bad as we know, but at the time, it was more akin to Ebola than it was to what we know now as a nasty but a controllable disease.
You've seen so much, we've heard so much from you on this podcast. Do you have any tips around mental health for journalists that you use, that you employ, that you've seen other journalists employ, that you think our listeners could take away with them?
I think what they need to do is to avail themselves of any and all psychological help that the companies now offer, and in fact, not just offer, but actually actively contact people coming back from hostile environments of any kind, by the way. This is, you know, war is one thing, but, you know, earthquakes are just as bad. And you must avail yourself of that. You know, I think back to my early years. If you said to the company, I can't do this because I need a break and it's really affected me, you'd sort of feel like, Stuart's lost it, he'll never go again. And that was something that I know I felt, and I know many colleagues who are doing a similar job, particularly in the United States, felt that they just basically would be signing their unemployment papers, right? That has all changed. Companies are now much more, well, I think they do a brilliant job. They couldn't have been better with us, but I know that they take care out of people that have bought what ostensibly don't look particularly dangerous or particularly stressful environments are very stressful to those people. And my best advice would be to, even if you're feeling fine, actually talk to someone, either a professional, but also talk to colleagues and talk to each other, which would be the best way. But talk. Don't keep it stuck in and don't say I'm fine. And again, really don't turn to drink.
I think one of the things that most struck me when we were researching to talk with you about this podcast was how you had moved some of the conversations around what goes on behind the scenes in the mental health into this programme Hotspots that you've presented in the past. And for me, that was a really interesting change in the conversation around impact of journalism on journalists. So I just want to ask you very briefly about that.
Yeah, the Hotspots idea was, it took some years to actually come to fruition, but the idea was that we wanted to show how we do things behind the scenes, why we do those things, and to give a format by which both me and Alex Crawford, who present it, but also Dominique and any of the producers and the crews who work with us, and particularly important, actually, producers from abroad who work with us, to have their input onto what they were thinking at any given time, but also about why we were doing it. And I think, you know, I think it's very popular. People stop at me often and ask me about it. And it's so popular with the bosses, but for some reason, but it is quite popular with people, and I think they find it interesting. And I know they did polling on it, and it was they'd never had a polling that showed it a positive on it by everyone. Even Game of Thrones, the most popular programme we've ever produced or been involved with, had negatives, but we had none, which made us think somebody likes it. I mean, they did lots of issues with it. They did different presenters and all that type of stuff, but they didn't actually dislike it. And I think that was what very important to us, was to get people to see what we were doing, it, how we were doing it, why we were doing it, but actually also to hear from the people who are part of the teams. And that was what I loved about it, actually. I was in it no more than the others.
Stuart, I think you're a great exponent of why journalism matters, but would you be so kind to tell us why you think journalism matters and why it's so important, just to wrap up?
I mean, it sounds as a bit an old adage, but it's absolutely true. We have to bear witness or the bastards get away with it. And it's as simple as that. And in this current era of fake news, etc., with presidents and prime ministers who lie routinely, it's absolutely more important now that we actually go and see it. If you don't go, you can't show. If you don't go, you don't see it. And so that's why journalism is so important, particularly our type of journalism. There's all sorts of other comment pieces, which is slightly different. But if you want people to see what's actually happening in the world, then you need reliable, honest journalists who go, aren't paid for by anyone else but a company, who has basic rules about independent journalism and waiting and all the rest of it. And that's why it's so important these days.
Stuart Ramsey, thank you so much for your time.
What an amazing conversation that was with Stuart. So many takeaways, Hannah. The thing that struck me was him talking about mundane things being good when you readjust, when you decompress, when you come back, and that it takes time, and accepting that it takes time, and that those poor coping mechanisms, turning to drink, doesn't really work.
Yes, John, it does take time. And I think what was really interesting about this is Stuart's been involved in the journalism industry for 30 years. So he's obviously seen things change significantly. And one of the things that I found really heartening was quite how much of an advocate he was for mental health conversations, for seeking out support and connecting with colleagues, for seeking out experts to speak with. And really, for me, it was a sense of trying to tackle some of the taboos that have existed around mental health conversations in journalism.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please remember to share it with family, friends and colleagues, and we'll be back again very soon.